look at where completely different areas that might just be of interest to you, right? Maybe you're a science person or engineering person, but you're really inspired by art. Always thinking about how do these things intersect? Where might there be that little nugget of a Venn diagram that nobody else is seeing?
Welcome to the Technical Difficulties Podcast. I'm Liz Gerber, and a design professor at Northwestern.
And I'm Lauren Lin, and I'm a student who has also worked in the design industry. Each week, we speak with women leaders in design and technology.
Today, we're excited to welcome Dr. Allison Bryant. She's an innovation leader, a self-described experience unicorn, having been in academia, media tech, started her own company, and a nonprofit executive. Today, she's the Chief Research Data and Impact Officer at Sesame Workshop. Previously, she's worked with children's media organizations such as Nickelodeon, Disney, Girl Scouts, and even led digital equity research at the American Association of Retired Persons. We can't wait to hear from Allison. Allison, thank you so much for joining us today.
So excited to be with you guys today. Thanks so much, Liz and Lauren.
Great. So to get us started, we have a couple fun warm-up questions. The first one is, what is your favorite way to start the morning?
My favorite way to start the morning, well, I have 5 kids, so alone. I usually make sure I wake up a little early, get a shot of espresso, and try to do a little bit of reading or sort of, collecting myself before the kids wake up.
That's amazing. I'm glad that you get that time early in the morning. How early is early when you say early?
Oh, that's a good question. Usually it kind of depends. It depends on if I'm commuting to New York that morning. But usually between about 4:30 and 5 typically. But I'm also in bed by 7:30 or 8 or 9. Like, I'm an early to bed. I've always been like that. Even when I was a teenager, I was the one up at 5:30 in the morning. So that is my natural rhythm, and I'm leaning into it.
I'm actually jealous of that. Okay, and our last one. What is your favorite creativity tool?
Yeah, such a great question. I would say, for me, I want to actually say Pinterest.
Okay, now we'll jump into it, Allison. Thank you for sharing a little personal moment. We want to know, how did you get your start in media and technology? And in particular, was there a moment when you said, this is the moment, I should be in this field? Or was it more in retrospect?
You know, I'm sure everybody says that they had a little bit of a winding path. But I did not want to be in kids and media and technology. That was the last thing I wanted to do, because I grew up in a household with my father was a professor, and one of the things he focused on was kids and media. He'd been a Spencer Fellow at Sesame Workshop in the 70s. So that was the last thing I wanted to do. I failed miserably. And I even did my PhD program, and I specifically went to the USD Annenberg School, because at the time there really wasn't anybody who was one of the big names in kids and media. And I was like, I'm going to get out of it. I'm not going to go do this, even though I was in the same field that my father's in. And I ended up studying organizational communication, focused on network analysis at macro levels. I was studying terrorist networks and all sorts of stuff. And but could not get myself away from kids and media, and just really always was interested in it. Ended up writing my dissertation on the evolution of the children's media community. So I took all the organizational stuff and then brought it back to kids media. So when I started my career, I was a professor at Indiana University. Ended up, of course, teaching the kids and media class. It's what they really were excited. I also taught social network stuff, but they really wanted me to do kids and media. And I just kind of fell in love with it all over again. I'd always been really passionate about it, and then had an opportunity a few years into being a professor to leave and go to Nickelodeon to build out their digital research practice. And I remember I went to my chair at the time and I said, I don't know what to do. I love being a professor. I love working with students. I was doing a lot of service learning in my classrooms and having students working with kids and media. And I said, I really love this. I don't know what to do. And he looked at me and he said, Allie, if you were my daughter, he goes, I'd tell you, of course, go to Nickelodeon. Think about all the people we want to hire right now, and as people who have this mix of academic and real world experience, go to Nickelodeon and go do something. And I was like, well, okay, you know, check mark, you know. And I don't think it was because I wasn't going to get tenure. I think it was just literally he was like, why not go do this? And I was young as well. I didn't have a family. Why not move to the city? Both my siblings had just moved there, so I did. And it was funny because I'd say probably 2 years later, I was still going to academic conferences. I actually published more once I got to Nickelodeon than I did as an academic because I had more interesting things, I thought, to say, right? You have to be inspired about what you're writing. And so I was at academic conferences still. I was still the editor of associate editor of Journal of Children and Media, and I was leading the Children Media Group for the National Communication Association, and we saw each other, and he goes, so remember that conversation we had? He goes, we've got an opening. You want to come back? And I just very nicely said, not yet. And it hasn't been yet.
Many years later. Okay, I have to dig back a little into what was, why were you so against going into the field that your father was in?
Oh, I think just what? Oldest child. Why were you so syndrome. Resistant? Yeah, I'm a lot like my father. And I think you always, you know, when you're in a teen, your early 20s, you just sort of rebel against usually the parent you're probably the most like. And of course, you know, he passed away recently, but of course we ended up being best buddies and actually writing, you know, editing books together. So we ended up, it ended up forging an even closer relationship between the two of us. But there's always that challenge. Like even when I came to Sesame, and I had worked with Sesame on my own in my professional life for many years before I got here. So I had a lot of connections, either because people I'd worked with while they're at Sesame or they'd been at Nickelodeon or I'd worked with them in other places because kids media and tech is still a relatively small space. But I remember the first week when I was actually on site and the CEO who I had known at Nickelodeon said to me, he goes, so apparently your father is like this big name in kids media. How did I not know that? He goes, when I hired you, half the people knew you because of you and half the people knew you because of you and happened to know who your dad was. And I was like, and that is why I didn't want to go into kids. I'm in a different place now. I've made my own name. It's all good. But, you know, uphill battle.
Thank you for recounting that whole journey and from academics to now like Sesame. And I want to know more about what you do at Sesame now, like as a chief research data and impact officer, like what does that mean? And how did you find that intersection of like data and storytelling and impact? Because I think that's really interesting and maybe not apparent to, you know, college students who are like just picking one major, but this feels very interdisciplinary and fun.
It is both or all of those things, Lauren. I'll start with where I am now, and then I'll sort of go back to maybe a couple of key moments for me and sort of how I found my way here. So I really wear two hats right now at Sesame. On the one hand, I lead our research and data teams. And so Sesame is built on a foundation of three core pillars, right? So research, education, and then creative and production. So since day one, we've always been grounded in research. Formative, summative evaluations, everything that you see that comes out of Sesame Workshop is tested. And we're in 150 countries around the world. We have, obviously, media programs. We have direct service work. We're in, right now, the past 10 years, or really 5 years, we've spent and done a lot of work with children who are displaced because of conflict and crisis. We're with Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh. We're with Syrian refugees in the Middle East. So we are literally in every context, everywhere in the world, on every platform, right? Whether it's toys or we have our own theme parks called Sesame Place in a couple of places. So we're everywhere and we test everything, right? And we make sure that we understand how kids are learning, how parents are engaged, and that we're meeting the outcomes we've set for ourselves in the core four impact areas that we focus on, which I'm happy to talk about in a little bit. So that's one side of our hat. And within that, I also, we have something called the Joan Gantz Cooney Center, which is a separate nonprofit that does just incredible work around innovation and design and engaging with industry and often sort of older kids and technology that was founded by our founder, Joan Gantz Cooney. So that rolls up under me as well. So that's one hat. The other is really working across the organization and saying, what is the impact we should be making in the world? Aligning us around these sort of core impact areas that have outcomes that we can measure, measuring those things, and then telling that story back out into the world, but also internally to ourselves, right? Like where are things working? Where are they not? Really helping to create more of a learning organization, to have more of that always on innovation mindset. That's really what I would say my team and our engine drives for the organization, which is really exciting. And we have been under a lot of transformation as well, which, you know, I could talk a little bit about. When I came in, Sesame's always made an impact. 55 years we've been around making an impact, and is the most studied program in the history of television. You know, and again, this is academic. This is third-party studies on Sesame Street. So, you know, yes, we make an impact.
Allison, I just want Allison, may I just make a moment to say,
sure.
Over 50 years of relevancy. I mean, that is just unheard of. It blows my mind, the reach and the relevancy of the programming. Just blows my mind. I can't even think of a point of comparison. Please push back if there is. It's unheard of.
No. I mean, we're talking about a unicorn. Like, we are a unicorn, you know, out there. And I would say also due to, you know, I was mentioning sort of global reach, being able to reach, you know, we cross between informal and formal learning, right? So we're meeting the kids at home with the parents. We're in schools. We're building curricula. So we really, and I think it's because we've always put the child at the center. And we can maybe get into this a little bit later when we think about design. We've always thought about designing at the edges, right? If you think about, you know, the distribution, we've always thought about how do you reach those hardest to reach kids that need us the most? And when you do that, you end up creating incredible products that work for everybody, right? I mean, that is universal design. That is, I think, the hallmark of that kind of work. And Sesame has done that from the beginning. The other thing that we've done, and this was what drew me to Sesame, other than just, you know, the Muppet magic and the history and all of that, is we are one of the oldest social enterprises. We don't necessarily call ourselves that out in the world. We have a double bottom line impact model. I will also say that's how I ended up at AARP, is that I was running my own company. I wasn't planning to leave, but I was fascinated with organizations that have a double bottom line, that really think about social enterprise and social entrepreneurship, which, Liz, I know you and I have a lot of deep feelings about. And I believe that that is the future of impact in our world. I don't think, it's not that nonprofits don't do great things. It's not that companies can't do great things. But if you're not really looking at the intersection of those two, and I would say, and also bring in academia, and that's what Sesame does. So Sesame brings together the nonprofit world, the academic world, and the industry world into an intersection of saying, how do we solve for problems that kids are facing around the world, around education, right? How do we leverage scalable technology and media to do that? But also, how are we hyper-contextualized into the location where those kids and families are to understand what they need? So we have, for almost day one, right? So day one was Sesame Street in the US. But then we quickly went into Brazil and Mexico and Germany, always co-productions. We weren't taking...
Allison, can you...
That's us as a global brand.
Can you illustrate... This is wonderful. I'm blown away by the Syrian refugees, the work you've been doing with the Syrian refugees. And I'm wondering if you can illustrate, like really concretely, what does that look like day-to-day, especially in that programming or related?
Yeah. So when we go into a new context, and the Syrian refugees is a great example. We were the first recipient with our partner IRC of the MacArthur 100 and Change Award. So $100 million. And the problem that we set out was, we have more displaced children in the world now than we've ever had. There are more displaced people since World War II. Half of them are children. How do we address comfort and care, education, when all of the consistency of daily life for them has been destroyed? And I will say, unfortunately, 5 years later, it's even worse, right? So that was the problem we set out to do. To do that, we went into context. So we do a needs assessment every time we're going into a new context, and we go in and we work with local parents and teachers and providers and contexts and say, hey, what are the problems we should be solving, right? This is not we do have core impact areas that we, you know, want to focus and have outcomes, but we're always contextualizing and saying, what is the most important problem we need to solve for children and families. And then I will say, mesh that with, okay, what are we actually good at Sesame? We're not getting diapers on the ground, right? Like, what is our lane? And who should we be partnering with, in this case, for the Syrian refugees? We already had IRC as a partner going into sort of developing the problem set. And then how do we go and solve this problem together, leveraging what we're really great at and what you're great at? What are the educational outcomes we need to be reaching? What, again, are the contexts? Are we in high or low tech? You know, what is the right model? And let me give you an example of both how we plan, but how we have to pivot too, with the Syrian refugees. So we went in and partnered with IRC, and we were creating curricula. IRC has these on the ground preschools, and obviously they have lots of services for refugees in context. And so we had created all this content with a new program called Ahlan Simpson, which was a whole child curriculum, but really focused on emotional well-being, knowing that these kids, like, that's what you have to address at the beginning. If you don't have emotional well-being and mental health and social emotional skills, you can't do the rest of it, right? And that's, of course, what they're dealing with. So we went in and we said, okay, we've created this program, again, with a partner in Jordan, right? Co-produced, we had local advisors for education, right? This is really thinking about it's hyper-local. Even having conversations around, like, what language should we be using. I mean, these are all the things that we spend so long working on before we ever put anything that's on screens. And so we're going and we're going to put this in the preschools. And then COVID happened. Couldn't go into preschools. And we were lucky that MacArthur, as a funder, which is not always the case, trusted us and was flexible and said, all right, how are you going to pivot? And we went back and we said, okay, we're going to take the content we've created. We're going to leverage these teachers that were supposed to be going into schools, can't go into schools now, right? And we're going to take these families that we knew the communities, and we're going to go low tech. We're going to use WhatsApp, and we're literally just going to create a virtual program, right? So the teachers had like small parent groups. The refugee families, and again, everything's contextually based, but we do think that there's interesting learning here as we can bring into their context. You know, the families, this was super important. This was their child's learning. It's not like this was supplemental. This was their education. And so we brought this content, we brought them on, and the teachers worked with the kids and parents, I think it was 3 days a week for 30 minutes. So pretty low dosage, and they did it over 11 weeks. And in 11 weeks, we were working with NYU. They were doing a summative evaluation for us. In 11 weeks, we were able to show outcomes equivalent to a year of in-person preschool. So these refugee kids who normally would have been left behind actually leap forward because we were able to partner and had the resources to get this. So we're looking at this and going, oh my God, what else could we do, right? Like, this is, it may not completely replicate somewhere else, but okay, so we leverage the teachers, we leverage the parents, we have the kids, we have the content. We found some secret sauce. So now we're looking and saying, how do we take that next? So that's just one example of how we go in and, you know, we're thinking always about, again, sort of scale, sustainability. The impact model that I've developed as I came in as the impact officer is to say, all right, we always need to measure ourselves on reach, right? Because for us, reach is super important. We're a media company or an education company. Engagement, because lots of people can reach a lot of people, but they don't necessarily have engaging content. I'm sure we've all experienced that with educational media, right? So engagement is critical, and then efficacy, right? And for us, it's almost like a funnel, right? You have to reach to teach, you have to engage, and then you have to show that the work you're doing is actually moving the needle on the outcomes that we've set out. And so that's how we measure ourselves, which is not easy, but we think is probably, in some respects, the most important thing we do.
Wow, that was like an amazing story. I also really appreciate how thoughtful your organization is around partnering with people on the ground and contextualizing your research and work and like co-producing, because I think that's so important. Like when we think about co-design and designing with people, like they are the experts, but you bring the resources and all that support. So I think that's such a great like case study and story for young designers to learn from. And I really want to get into designing at the edges because you brought that up earlier and it sounded really interesting. So if you want to dive into it now, the floor is yours.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, thinking about the themes, I mentioned already sort of social enterprise and thinking about things as a double bottom line, right? That things have to be efficacious but sustainable. So that's one through line for me. The other is this idea of designing at the edges. And, you know, so most of my career in the kids space, and that's a really special population. They have very unique needs. So even across the population of people, I would say they're at the edge. I spent 5 years at AARP on the other side of the age edge. And one of the things that drew me there was because, again, it's a special population. If you think about whether it's, you know, conducting research or designing technology, or you think of this idea of inclusive design, if you design at the age edges for older adults and for younger kids, you end up creating content that or platforms or whatever that end up working, right? Whether that's because of, you know, cognitive abilities because it's in development, or you're dealing with, you know, lack of cognitive abilities at the older age of the age spectrum, or you know, gross and fine motor skills, right? There's a whole range of things that sort of come up with these ages. I think that's one thing. The other thing with designing at the edges is, again, and this is where Sesame has always had an incredible, and I should say AARP too, is meeting those people who have the lowest resources, or who are in the context that have the least resources, or the biggest barriers, right? So Sesame was designed for, in the US at the time, inner city Black Latino kids, right? It's why they had the cast that was diverse that they did. That caused a lot of upheaval, but they were designed because those kids at the time were not, this is when Universal Preschool and Head Start and things like that were being created in that sort of era, those kids were not meeting the benchmarks that they needed, right? They were not ready to learn when they got to school. That's why Sesame started. Same thing when we're going into, you know, a refugee crisis, we're going in and we're saying, these are the hardest to reach kids. If we can create something, and actually going back to Auckland Sims is another great example. So that was created for the refugee crisis. But that program ended up getting picked up by NBC3 in the Middle East. It is now viewed, our latest viewing data showed that almost half of kids in our, you know, in our age range are watching it, almost half. And 3/4 of those are watching it 5 days a week, like basically every day of the week. So we're not just getting those refugee kids that we were developing the content and the programming for, right? We're also getting the whole region, because that programming, all kids need emotional well-being. And importantly, when you're especially thinking about refugees in host countries, you're able to represent experiences of the other, right? Of someone like a refugee kid or somebody, or a minority in a country that then the mass audience sees. And so you're developing empathy, right? So you're really creating this beautiful sort of virtuous cycle by designing at the edges where you're working for everybody. Another good example of that, I think, is, and this is a very tactical one, but when I was working at Nickelodeon and leading their digital research practice, we were in the process of redesigning nickjr.com. And what we were doing at the time was the producers had done sort of like a parent-facing nickjr.com, and then it was like more resources and, you know, things for parents and information. And then they did the kid-facing one that was, keep in mind this was 15 years ago, right? Like the button iconography with the characters on it, right? And we tested it, and what we found, the parents wanted the same interface as the kids. Why? It was easier. It was intuitive. It was pictorial. And so one of the things that we sort of built in from our design practice from then, it was like that aha moment, right? Where we go, oh, right. If we design it for the kids, the parents are going to be able to navigate it easier too. So we started saying, let's design it for the younger kids and bring it and bring the adults into that experience. So I think those are just a couple of examples. You know, AARP is another great example. So there I was leading the research center, but I was also leading all of our social impact work around technology and digital equity. And so there we were really focused on working with organizations, whether, you know, it was big tech companies or somebody else, to say, are you including? Okay, great, you're doing VR, you're doing whatever. Are you including older adults as part of your use case? Because often what happens is they want the market because it's the biggest market. The 50 plus is the largest market. It's got the most money. But they would never design for that. That those stereotypes, the age discrimination, which, by the way, is one of the worst things we have, especially in media tech right now, is really inherent in those workforces, who tend to be younger. They wouldn't be designing for them. So they would create something, they'd want the market, but they would never design for it. Right? So, but if they designed for it, it would have actually probably done pretty well in the broader market. So that was sort of our value proposition to a certain extent.
So much to think about there, Allison. So we've talked about the present, look forward a little. What's something you personally want to still learn, work on? You've done so many things. What else is still out there that intrigues you?
I'm always really interested in the win-win-win, meaning, you know, any problem that has to be solved always has at least three. It's never a win-win, right? So if you're solving for, and I'll give you an example of one of the things I'm really excited about right now, is our work in thinking about how we solve for assessment in early childhood, which is just broken on every level, right? It's broken for kids because it's boring. It's hard to get their attention. Kids coming out of COVID can't pay attention anyway, right? They've been on screens and all this kind of stuff. So broken for kids. Broken for teachers. Those teachers are so strapped. There's fewer of them. They're underpaid. They're under-resourced. They've got all these kids. They don't have time to do this, right? Parents aren't brought into the process. And administrators, it's hard to see the data and what does it actually mean for them, right? So that's four people it's broken for. So we're really excited about taking the depth of research and background and the work we do in playful learning and play-based work and bringing that into solving that problem and actually productizing it. So my big thing right now is how do we take all this incredible knowledge that we have, not just at Sesame, as the career of early childhood, as academics, and how do we start to bring that more and more into productized innovation that actually shows up in the marketplace? I'd say that's my sweet spot. I've always helped organizations do that. I want to be even more in the hands-on side of that. So we're doing some of that at Sesame. And really thinking about solutions at this intersection of both global and hyperlocal. So how do we solve for something like play-based assessment in a way that you can have a global product so it's sustainable, right? You can actually make something that works, that's play-based, that's intuitive to kids, that solves all these other problems, but then we'll actually work within very local context because often the decisions are made, you know, on what people are going to adopt or what they're going to use in a really local way. So that, I'd say those are the problems right now that I'm trying to solve. I think that's where I think Sesame is so uniquely positioned, is because all these things, right? Social enterprise and designing at the edges and, you know, all these things make us this unicorn that can solve problems in ways that nobody else can. There's nobody who's out there like us. And so I think we're uniquely positioned. I know we're uniquely positioned. I know that we, like, for example, we're really looking right now because we get both corporate commercial funding and we get nonprofit funding. We have licensed products in the market, right? So we literally have revenue that's commercially generated or is coming from license fees from our programming. And then, you know, we get $100 million from MacArthur, which was followed on by $100 million from Lego, right? So we have those, by the way, don't always happen. But so we have this dual revenue stream. And to be honest, as an organization, because of that, we'd sort of gotten pushed into two different groups. And so part of my role at Sesame has been, we've been calling it One Sesame, is how do we bring us back together into this view of social enterprise, right? Where all boats rise when you work closer together, that organizations, even if they're commercially driven, if you give them the choice of doing well for kids and not with the same revenue and the same, you know, financial, they're always going to pick doing well. No one doesn't want to do well. So how do we create those solutions that are the option that they have? So that's a lot of what I'm working on internally, but also externally. How do we, like on the assessment side, how do we leverage nonprofit or grant funding to build something, but always have an eye towards productizing and having a commercial market or even solving commercial market issues, right? In that particular case, we're looking to build an ecosystem of assessments. We're not actually building the assessments, but we know there's tons of people who are doing incredible work, whether it's an AI or AR or VR, but they can't scale, right? So how do we solve their market issue? We solve the problem that we know is there for kids and teachers and parents and the whole circle of care for children. And we're, you know, solving problems, and again, for sort of like the teachers and administrators. So anyway, I'm a complex systems thinker. That was actually what I was working on in grad school. So I always see things as complex systems, and I'm an optimist, and I firmly believe we can solve things. We just have to look at them a little bit differently than we necessarily have. And I think design thinking, and I think the way that you approach things where you bring consumers and their problem to the center as opposed to the other way around is the way in for doing that.
Okay, wow. I just have to say this is so incredibly inspiring. Also to hear from someone who's worked at a like unicorn organization where you blend research and insights, storytelling, content creation, that is just so incredibly exciting. And for me personally, that's like a lot of my passion. So hearing that it can come together and you can work cross-functionally in an organization like this and also partner with academia is really cool. So I'm wondering, for young students who are excited about all these areas and maybe hope to work in an organization like yours one day, what are a couple pieces of advice do you have for students either in school or recently graduated who are looking for an experience like yours?
I think what has really led me down my very winding path is that I have always, just taken any open door that came. That doesn't actually changing organizations, but you know, I always was looking for what's that adjacency? What's that other thing that I can bring out? Who's that other person that I could collaborate with? And what that has meant is over time, as an executive, you know, they've put different kinds of roles under me because they're like, oh, well, she's going to learn, right? She's a learner. She can take that, or she has a big vision. She can see how these things fit together. And so I think trying to always look at adjacencies, also look at where completely different areas that might just be of interest to you, right? Maybe you're a science person or engineering person, but you're really inspired by art. Always thinking about how do these things intersect? Where might there be that little nugget of a Venn diagram that nobody else is seeing, right? I think that's where we're seeing incredible innovation happening. And even if it doesn't show up in your professional life, it's going to help you in your personal life because it's going to help keep you inspired, right, in a lot of different ways. So I think sort of having that open aperture is really important. I always, always, always recommend internships, fellowships, anything you can do to get work, even if it's, again, tangential to what you want to do. I always say an internship is just as good for finding out what you don't want to do as what you do. So not being sad if you win an internship and realize it's not what you really wanted to do, great. That's one thing you've checked off, right? I would also say, and this is going to be my bias as a researcher, but even if you're not a researcher, finding opportunities to engage in research or even do research kind of internships are so important because research is always working across an organization. They have eyes on, you know, depending on what kind of organization, you know, marketing and communication and product development, whatever. That's really unusual. There's not a lot of groups that tend to service the broader organization. So you get a sense of what people do. And the last thing I think is always think about your audience. And, I say this as a student, but I think that storytelling is one of the most powerful or one of the biggest superpowers you can have. You know, I always said that my superpower early on in my career was speaking producer. That even though I was a researcher and I came from academia, I didn't give them a 20-page white paper on the user experience of their game. I literally gave them screenshots with circles that said, like, here's your game, do this. And that was really new. But it's because I knew, A, there was an attention span, they were visual learners. Like, who am I speaking to? And that could be your professor, that could be your students, you know, that could be a lot of different people. But think about what that looks like. And then anytime you're communicating with someone, and today may not have been my best example of that, by the way, what are the 3 to 5 things you want to leave them with, right? And I know that sounds trite, but, you know, I was very lucky that I had an executive early on in my career, who, by the way, is currently my CEO when he hired me to Sesame, but he really trained me. You know, I would be gone for 2 weeks doing all this work, and I'd come back, and he'd be like, you've been gone for 2 weeks. What are the 3 things I should know? And at the time, it was painful. But now I'm so thankful because I am constantly synthesizing and I can walk in any room and say, these are the three things you need to know, pretty off the cuff. Thinking about that, not trying to always boil the ocean, whoever, you know, again, it could be, you know, not a random person on the street, but the person in the elevator, you know, who asks you a question, what's your elevator pitch? How are you always giving people the most important thing? Because we have attention issues, right, as a society, and information issues as a society. I think the way forward is being able to be clear and concise, which that answer was not. But don't do it. Do as I say, not as I just did.
I'm going to give you an opportunity to be very concise. I thought that was brilliant. I first want to thank you for sharing your time and stories with us, Allison. And my concise question for you is, or opportunity for you, is which Sesame character do you find most inspiring today? And as you're thinking about that, I'm going to share mine. Mine is Oscar the Grouch. And I think Oscar the Grouch, for me, always represented the possibility that you could be in a bad mood and still be accepted and welcomed by your community. And so with that, hopefully you've had time. I'm curious which character is most inspiring to you.
Do I get to ask Lauren first before I reveal mine?
Yes. Didn't know she was going to be asked. So yes, Lauren, who's yours right now off the cuff and why?
I'll say Elmo, which is basic, but I grew up watching Elmo. And I think the way that you're able to be welcomed into the Sesame Street world as a kid so graciously and in a very playful way by Elmo it was like a comfort creator for me. And there's like comfort creators on TikTok now, but like pre-TikTok, Elmo was the OG.
Elmo is OG TikTok. So mine is absolutely, Super Grover is my spirit animal. Because he always sees the positive. He has such tenacity. He does not always get it right. Sometimes he has a problem admitting that. So maybe that he really is my spirit animal. But I love Super Grover. I really love how he wants to constantly try and try and try again to solve a problem. And I think that if we all had a little more Super Grover in us, including a very unrealistic ego, we'd probably all do a little better.
Thank you, Allison, for sharing that with us, your stories, your insights, your expertise.
That was Allison, and you can find out more about her work in the show notes. And you can learn more about this show by going to technicaldifficultiespodcast.com. Drop us a note at technicaldifficultiesteam@gmail.com or leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. It really helps people discover the show. We're especially curious to know what stories and insights resonated.
This show is produced by Lauren Lin and Liz Gerber and made possible by the Center for Human-Computer Interaction and Design at Northwestern. Thank you so much for listening.